Dave, Lord Krishna, Mahapurusha of the Supreme Person, Rupa of the Form, Upalakshane, having the symptoms, Srivatsa, the mark on the chest of the Lord, Kaustubha, the Kaustubha gem used by the Lord. Vanamala, flower garland. Aridara, by the disc and conch shell. What does Ari mean? Yeah, I think so, yeah. So I think they're the word for the disc, by the disc and conch shell. Interesting. Anyway, the disc is certainly used for the enemies. Gada adi bihi, by the club and other symbols. Upalakshite, being recognized. Nija Purusha Hrit Likhitena, which is situated in the heart of his own devotee, like an engraved picture. Atmani, in his own mind. Purusha Rupena, by his personal form. Virochamane, shining. Uchaistaram, on a very high level. Bhakti, devotional service. Anudinam, day after day. Edamana, increasing. Raya, possessing force. Ajayata, appeared. Translation. In this way, being purified by ritualistic sacrifices, the heart of Maharaj Bharat was completely uncontaminated. His devotional service unto Vasudev, Lord Krishna, increased day after day. Lord Krishna, the son of Vasudev, is the original personality of Godhead, manifest as the Supersoul, Paramatma, as well as the impersonal Brahman. Yogis meditate upon the localized Paramatma situated in the heart. Jnanis worship the impersonal Brahman as the Supreme Absolute Truth, and devotees worship Vasudev, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose transcendental body is described in the Shastras. His body is decorated with the Sri Vatsa, the Kaustubha jewel, and a flower garland, and his hands hold a conch shell, disc, club, and lotus flower. Devotees like Narada always think of him within their hearts. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Lord Vasudev, or Sri Krishna, the son of Vasudev, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is manifest within the hearts of yogis in his Paramatma feature, and he is worshipped as impersonal Brahman by jnanis. The Paramatma feature is described in the Shastras as having four hands holding disc, conch shell, lotus flower, and club. As confirmed in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 2, Verse number 8, Kechit Svadehanto Hrida Yog Vakashe Pradesha Matram Purisham Vasantam Jatubujam Kunjara Tanga Sankhya Gadadaram Dharanaya Smaranti. Paramatma is situated in the hearts of all living beings. He has four hands, which hold four symbolic weapons. All devotees who think of the Paramatma within the heart worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead as the temple deity. They also understand the impersonal features of the Lord and his bodily rays, the Brahman effulgence. In this way, being purified by ritualistic sacrifices, the heart of Maharaj Bharat was completely uncontaminated. His devotional service unto Vasudev, Lord Krishna, increased day after day. Lord Krishna, the son of Vasudev, is the original personality of Godhead, manifest as the Supersoul, Paramatma, as well as the impersonal Brahman. Yogis meditate upon the localized Paramatma situated in the heart. Jnanis worship the impersonal Brahman as the supreme absolute truth. And devotees worship Vasudev, the supreme personality of Godhead, whose transcendental body is described in the Shastras. His body is decorated with the Sri Vatsa, the Kaustubha jewel, and a flower garland, and his hands hold a conch shell, disc, club, and lotus flower. Devotees like Narada always think of him within their hearts. Om Ajnana Timurandasa Janandana Shalakaya Chakshuru Militang Jaina Tasmai Shri Gurve Namaha Panchakalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyevicha Paditanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar, Shivashadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Yesterday we heard from Mother Anandini, very interesting class, how Maharaj Bharat, after whom India is named, a very important person in our tradition, performed yajna, sacrifice. And some questions were raised as to how the performance of sacrifice can be pure devotional service. Why did he do that? And it raises some pertinent questions about the relationships between the different spiritual disciplines or forms of yoga. This verse also equates the different processes with different concepts of the Supreme Lord. So how do we explain this? The relationship between the different processes, the different forms of yoga, the different disciplines. On one hand, we might become too liberal and all start engaging in the processes of karma or jnana or yoga. We might become heretics or something on one side. No? We might become too liberal. Some devotees already tend to use more of the, even during japa period, they may actually sit properly or they may engage even in some breathing processes. Are we to condemn that? Or are we to support that? Where does it fit in? So on one side we may become too liberal. On the other side, there is a chance we might actually condemn everything except bhakti, in an attempt perhaps to raise bhakti to the highest position or to express how bhakti is important above other processes. But here we see this verse seems to challenge this view to a degree because Maharaj Bharat was performing yajna. Does that make sense? Is there a bit of a tension there, understanding those? I mean, the other day I heard some, I've heard recently some criticisms of academics. And of course we have a college here So where does that process fit in? What do we mean by academia? And how does academia relate to devotional service? What is the role perhaps of scholarship, to use another word, in devotional service? After all, I think the word academy came from the, you can tell me from, those of you know Greek philosophy, it actually came from the olive grove where the first university, they say, was actually established. Am I right? What is the situation? Who was that set up by? Was it Plato? It was Plato. And it was in the grove? Sorry, I didn't want to turn. A group of trees, it was actually named after the specific location. That's what it grew out of, actually. So we often hear of the academy to refer broadly to groups of universities, you know, scholarship. And we also hear of the tension between the academy and the church, or between faith and reason, or sometimes we say between Jerusalem and Athens. It's expressed like that. So there is some important questions here. I was actually thinking how we refer to the great soul as Paramahansa. Paramahansa. The topmost swan-like person. And the swan is used as an analogy for two reasons, interestingly. One is the whole idea of purity. The swan is a pure animal. It has a certain grace. It's white. Srila Prabhupada says how it lives in scenic places, although in Kali Yuga we tend to find them sometimes living in not such nice bodies of water. But generally speaking, it's a beautiful animal. It's compared to the crow, which we tend to see everywhere. I don't know, pretty well every country I go to, we seem to find crows. But they tend to congregate where there's rubbish. And they have little discrimination, therefore. So there is an idea, whereas the swan can apparently take milk from a mixture of milk and water. It has that ability somehow. If it's given a mixture of milk and water, it can take just the milk and leave the water. So we also, it's just like devotees, they become expert. When they're subji, they're expert in separating the cheese from the rest of the subji. That's our devotee discrimination, Paramahansa. I remember being in Ireland and I was saying to the senior devotee, I said, I'd like more subji. She said, this isn't subji. She said, it's just cheese and tomato sauce. I thought, that's good subji. Discrimination must be there. It is called viveka. We have the famous Hindu leader Vivekananda, the bliss of discrimination. So there is discrimination, which is generally associated with knowledge or wisdom, that ability to discriminate. But also interesting, there is the idea of purity with the swan. And it's mentioned here, purity of heart, how Maharaj Bharat became completely pure in heart. So we do really need to understand this, the relationship between the different paths. There's also a connection between the different yogas or margas or paths and the concept they have, the followers have, of the Supreme, which is interesting. The concept they have and also whom they worship. The different paths tend to worship different deities, interestingly enough. Mm-hmm. The yogis, for example, they tend to favor Shiva, or Shiva and Shakti. Interesting. The Vaishnavas tend to favor Vishnu. let me see. I was trying to, actually, as I was thinking, I was trying to actually analyze what are the different features of the various paths and how do we need to discriminate. I'm going to read a quote which Mother Mahalakshmi sent out. Some of you may have a week or two ago. And I'm trying to find it. Here it is. This is from the Sri Chaitanya Shikshamrita of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He's actually talking about the different types of false renunciants, which is very interesting. Four different classes of renunciants: monkey renunciants, false renunciants, unsteady renunciants, and imitative. Renunciants. I won't read them all here, although they are quite interesting. But Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur concludes, the renunciation arising from bhakti is the beauty of devotional life. To become renounced and then search out bhakti is unnatural and in most cases disastrous. Interesting, I won't get into that too much. Renunciation or detachment is the special ornament of the person who has attained bhava. It is not an anger of bhakti, but the symptom of bhakti. So it's important to differentiate here. Even though we may say renunciation is not an anger of bhakti, and it actually cannot give us devotional service. In other words, it's not the cause of success in spiritual life, but it is a symptom of that. And so we need to differentiate between various aspects. What are those different aspects? In the previous verse, there was some mention of understanding who is the focus of sacrifice. Bhoktaram jagatapasam Savaloka Maheshvaram Suridam Sava Bhutanam Gyatvamam Shantim Richti. There it's mentioned one should understand that the bhokta, the enjoyer of sacrifices, is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. Interestingly, however, even though we may say actually the important point is that we worship Krishna and no one else, Srila Prabhupada does mention in the previous purport, we should worship, of course I'm reading this out of context, so don't take the should in the wrong way. We should worship the demigods in that spirit. And he's talking about actually worship of Durga as being worshipped as a servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there is some endorsement for actually worshipping the demigods there. There is also some discussion of purity or the intention. In other words, is it the intention that makes the worship or the path we're following different? Is that what differentiates genuine bhakti? Is it the intention? Is it whom we worship? What are the other aspects? There is some discussion of purity. Work done as a sacrifice for Vishnu has to be performed, otherwise work binds one to the material world. In other words, it has to be done with the intention of pleasing Vishnu. Of course, there is pointing also to the particular focus of worship. I've come up with four categories relating to these different paths. One, and we can see whether or not, does bhakti have any connection to the other yogas in terms of these? In other words, do we differentiate bhakti based on any of these criteria? One, is bhakti differentiated from the other paths in terms of intention? What we're trying to do, the purpose. Is it differentiated in terms of the specific practices we're using? I'm talking about the practices are there in bhakti yoga, in karma yoga, Jnana Yoga, Ashtanga Yoga, or Bhakti Yoga, is it differentiated in terms of the results we get, or the symptom as mentioned here, and is it differentiated in terms of whom we worship? These are some interesting questions. Here, in this verse, we're mentioning three paths, Jnana Yoga, Ashtanga Yoga, and Bhakti Yoga. And interesting, in the previous verse, there was really a mention of the path of Karma Yoga. And they have different concepts of the Supreme, which is something also to mention. The concept in the Karma Yoga was of many gods, generally speaking. And we find in different civilizations throughout the world, many of them have this idea of a pantheon of gods. There are so many different pantheons, whether it's the Greek, the Roman, the Armenian, the Egyptian, several African pantheons of gods, the Nordic, the Norse pantheon. In Greece, they've categorized, there's 8 categories of gods. And the main ones, I think, are what are called the Olympian gods, of which there are 12, although there's some controversy about who's there. and I think Zeus corresponds to Indra. He has the thunderbolt. Similarly, in Norse mythology, when I was a student, I was very fond of reading some comics about Thor. And at one Christmas, my father even bought me a big plastic hammer as a Christmas present because I liked Thor comics. who is he in the Roman? Thor? Jupiter, yes, probably Jupiter. And interestingly, in Rome, they had a lot of male-female deities who were usually married, Jupiter with Juno, Neptune with Minerva, Mars and Venus, although apparently they were lovers, they weren't married. Some similar parallels with our own tradition. Norse pantheon, they had also Odin, the Supreme, I think, Balder, and the Vedic pantheon. During the time of the when there were sacrifices, then there were many different deities, particularly Indra and Agni were predominant at that time, so they say. Of course, it's interesting, there are slightly different opinions about between scholars and those who are members of the tradition about this Vedic period, but it is mentioned in our Shastra that there were different forms of worship. And this is from the, even from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the beginning of the Bhagavatam. Kalimagatam gyaya shetrasmin vaishnave vayam asinar dhiga satrena katayang sakshana hare. Knowing well that the age of Kali has already begun, we are assembled here in this holy place to hear at great length the transcendental message of Godhead, and in this way perform sacrifice. So the word sacrifice is used again. Srila Prabhupada mentions in the purport, this age of Kali is not at all suitable for self-realization, as was Satya Yuga, the golden age, or Treta or Dwapara Yugas, the silver and copper ages. For self-realization, the people in Satya Yuga, living a lifetime of 100,000 years, were able to perform prolonged meditation. And in Treta Yuga, when the duration of life was 10,000 years, self-realization was attained by performance of great sacrifice. And in the Dwapara Yuga, when the duration of life was 1,000 years, self-realization was attained by worship of the Lord, the process of puja, worship. But in the Kali Yuga, when the maximum duration of life being 100 years only, and that combined with various difficulties... So then, the process is hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. Here, Srila Prabhupada mentions, by the example of these sages, one should learn that regular hearing and recitation of the Bhagavatam is the only way for self-realization. So hearing and chanting in the process of sankirtan. But despite this, we do actually in our tradition perform the havan, the fire yajna. Again, that raises various questions. So I'd like to just study the different paths and study these four criteria, which are the intention. Is it the intention that makes the path correct? Is it the specific practices we adopt? Is it the result that is important? Or is it important whom we worship? These questions. In terms of intention, then we have a verse from Rupa Goswami, Anya bilazita sunyam, jnana kamadhyanavritam, anukul yena krishnanu, shilanam bhakti uttamam. When first-class devotional service develops, one must be devoid of all material desires. Knowledge obtained by monistic philosophy and fruitive action. The devotees must constantly serve Krishna favorably as Krishna desires. It's interesting, in the previous verse actually it's mentioned that Maharaj Bharat was actually performing sacrifice under the instruction of Vasudev, Krishna. So there's some concept here that actually it is the intention that is important, that is purified. That's what differentiates bhakti from other paths. The intention simply to serve Krishna with no desire to enjoy the world, nor with any desire to renounce the world and attain liberation. It has nothing to do with either of those. What about practice? Well, this is interesting because bhakti includes elements of action. In fact, Srila Prabhupada translated bhakti quite unusually as devotional service, whereas many from the Hindu tradition will translate bhakti as devotion, a kind of feeling or a sentiment. And they will write that bhakti is meant for those who are sentimental. And particularly the jnanis say that. It's very good, but it's for those who are sentimental. However, we who are jnanis, we know better. That's the general opinion. That is a misunderstanding of bhakti. Therefore, Srila Prabhupada translated it as devotional service. So it includes action. We could also explore what its relationship is to jnana, because actually that sentimental approach to bhakti is only symptomatic of the kanishtha stage of life. As one progresses to madhyam, at least according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, one starts to engage with trying to understand bhakti. Therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that actually the kanishtha appears to have stronger faith than the madhyam. He appears to have stronger faith. And the madhyam seems to be kind of a little shaky. Why? Because he or she is starting to ask and develop real knowledge. There's inquiry going on, real inquiry. Tadvidi pradipatena paripreshnena sevaya upadekshanti te jnanam jnaninas tatvadarshinaha. There must be three things. There must be the submission, humility, because that's the beginning of all qualities. There must also be practical service, action. And there must be inquiry. They must be there. Srila Prabhupada writes, it is after great deliberation that we take to the process of bhakti. And some of us may have personal experience of that deliberation we've undergone. Very important. In terms of practice, bhakti includes selfless and ritualistic action. Bhakti includes study of the shastras. We're studying now. This is a process of knowledge, but it's connected to Krishna. Bhakti includes meditation, japa, recitation of the Gayatri mantra, meditation on the form of the Lord during puja. There are very strong elements of meditation within the worship. And interestingly, the opposite way around, not only does bhakti include many of the elements of the other yogas in terms of practice, but actually the other forms of yoga, karma yoga, jnana yoga, astanga yoga, very often need devotion to be successful. In fact, if you look at Astanga yoga, which is the path of eight steps, yama niyama, asana, pratyahara, pranayam, jhana, dharana, jhana, samadhi. The first two are yama and niyama. Yama means the things you don't do, five restrictions. Niyama means the positive things, the do's. So thou shalt not and thou shalt. Necessary, which is why much yoga practice these days associated with Astanga yoga, Hatha yoga, is actually bogus because they don't follow the yama and the niyama. You must follow those processes first. And in the niyama, one of the niyamas is Ishvara Pranidhana, worship of Isha, the Supreme Lord. It's necessary for success. Many followers of Shankara point to the need for worship of the Lord. Of course, we know that Shankara himself, Bhaja Govindam, that very famous prayer, he says, "Adore the Lord, adore the Lord." I'm reading a translation, Bhaja, or "Worship the Lord, O fool, Mude." Before, when the appointed time, by appointed time means death, comes, the repetition of grammatical rules will not save you. So he's pointing actually to the defects of the process of knowledge, philosophical knowledge. Well, we may involve learning some grammatical rules. It won't save you. And they do actually point to the importance of bhakti. There is a quote someone, I didn't manage to find it, that says that actually that yoga, any of the yogas, will not be possible without that element of bhakti. It must be there. So it's interesting, even though we've got these separate forms of yoga, different paths, they're actually very closely connected. And this is one of the points I'd like to point out generally. It is very difficult to really understand the truth clearly. Mm-hmm. There is generally within our Vedic, Vaishnav or Hindu, whatever we call it, tradition, a very holistic understanding of the truth. It is not based on, saying not this, not this. Of course, that is the process of jnana. Not this, not that. We try to take, reach transcendence by denying other things. Mm-hmm. The process is called neti-neti. In Christianity, it's called via negativa. It's the way. So you start to understand, I'm not this body. I'm not this mind. That is also a part of our process as well. But without, and we can come to some conclusion by that reflection. It's not difficult. I think all of us have come to some kind of, got some kind of insight through that process. But without understanding the positive, what is the real identity of the self, it will not stand. We cannot keep that position. So that there's a very kind of holistic understanding of transcendence here. And it seems that actually the bhakti yoga in some ways is above all these, but at the same time it includes certain elements of them. That is in terms of practice. Certainly our practices have strong elements of action, strong elements of knowledge. There are very clear meditational aspects within the worship itself. What about results? This is interesting. In terms of result, it seems that actually it is necessary to actually say that we have some bhakti to have jnana and vairagya. In other words, we may actually say that jnana is not necessary to attain bhakti, nor is vairagya necessary to attain bhakti. The point is that unless you have jnana, and unless you have vairagya, you are not on a very high level of bhakti. So we need to differentiate there. So we should be very careful about knocking jnana and renunciation. They may not be the cause, but we do need to develop them. I'll read one quote from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 2, Verse 12. The process of meditation recommended here is bhakti yoga, or the process of devotional service after one is liberated from the material conditions. Jnana yoga is the process of liberation from the material conditions. After one is liberated from the conditions of material existence, i.e., when one is nivritti, as previously stated herein, or when one is freed from all material necessities, one becomes qualified to discharge the process of bhakti yoga. That's another interesting statement, isn't it? That actually after brahma-bhuta prasanatma na shokchiti na kankshiti samaksarveshu bhuteshu madbhaktim labhate param. Yeah, so the Brahman realization is being described here. It's typified by we don't lament, we don't hanker. And at that point, when you reach there, that mud bhakti, bhakti actually starts. It raises more questions, doesn't it? Does that mean we're not... If I'm not on the Brahman platform, am I practicing devotional service? Yes, we are, and there was the whole interesting discussion yesterday on what we mean by a pure devotee. And we really need to hang on to that, two definitions of pure devotee. I won't go through it again, but some of you will remember. What was the example of how we describe a pure devotee? And it may include those who are actually pure, and those who are on the path following a pure devotee. Yes. Yes, and the other? And what was the analogy? Yeah, the doctor. The doctor's called doctor. And if he just stays on the path, he'll actually become a doctor. And he's called a doctor. They call them respectfully. Doctor. But if he falls down or stops his studies or her studies, then they weren't considered a doctor and they're no longer qualified to be called a doctor. So if we stick on the path, we're also... And Srila Prabhupada used those. So we shouldn't become confused when we're actually hear that someone is a pure devotee and then we see some flaw in them. Because they may not be pure, they may not be on that level of perfection, but they're still to be considered a pure devotee. That'll help us deal with some of these issues. Here Srila Prabhupada says, after one is liberated from the conditions of material existence, one becomes qualified to discharge the process of bhakti yoga. Therefore, bhakti yoga includes jnana yoga, or in other words, the process of pure devotional service simultaneously serves the purpose of jnana yoga. Liberation from material conditions is automatically achieved by the gradual development of pure devotion. Therefore, the results come. Srila Prabhupada even mentions that all the results of a karma yoga come. And he mentions that, generally speaking, those who become religious, they become wealthy. They get the facilities. So if we're not wealthy, perhaps we're not following well enough. I don't know. but we should... We are sitting in the castle, and it's a pretty nice room, this, I must say, actually. Yes, it's good. We are. We are sitting in a castle. It's a fact. And, you know, we haven't really got that much anxiety, unless you're really Chaitanya, of course, about the bills, or one or the other. management team here, they are worrying, and that's part of their service, and so on, and we should be grateful for that. But the fact is, this has come without really us putting much endeavor in thinking about that. It's there. Srila Prabhupada actually mentions the opulence of a pure devotee is never lost. It continues from life to life. It'll come. That's a fact. The results will come. Jnana is mentioned here, will come. We have to have knowledge. And Vairagya also will come automatically. So in terms of result, it comes. What about the... do we differentiate bhakti in terms of the beneficiary, who, the person whom we're offering sacrifice or worship to? The previous verse has suggested we can worship demigods. It's okay as long as we worship them in their capacity as pure devotees. Here's an interesting conversation. Devotee, Prabhupada, is it possible for one to engage himself in bhakti yoga without rendering service to Krishna? Let's say someone who, Prabhupada, without Krishna, where is bhakti? Devotee, well, someone is worshipping Lord Buddha or Lord Jesus. Prabhupada, that is not bhakti yoga. Bhakti yoga is simply in connection with Krishna. Bhakti yoga cannot be applied to anyone, anything else. How Buddha philosophy can be dovetailed with bhakti yoga? Bhakti yoga means to understand God. Bhakcha mam mijanati. You'll find in the Bhagavad Gita, 18th chapter, by bhakti yoga, you can understand the Lord, the Supreme Lord, God. But in Buddha philosophy, there is no God. I mean, there's not even a self in Buddhism. That you know? So where is bhakti yoga? Interesting, Srila Prabhupada seems to be taking a quite strong line there. Maybe we could actually, maybe I could add a fifth category here. Maybe it's the organization we're in. Does that determine whether we're bona fide? After all, the word kami, it means fruitive actors. It's interesting, I've mentioned before how sometimes the word kami now means generically someone who's not a devotee, an ISKCON devotee. It's kind of become a little bit of an us-them word. As happens in many religions. Interesting. I think it was, who's the name of the... Oh, Kabir, the great medieval saint. He actually would meet with some of the different people of different faiths, and he drew a lot from the Hindu tradition, the Vedic tradition. He drew a lot from Islam as well. But he would meet with some Islamic scholars, and he would, they have the word kafir, which means infidel, the infidels. And of course, it's quite used a lot in terms of Islamic terrorism these days, killing infidels and so on, and going to heaven rather quickly. But Kabir would actually meet with them and say, actually, it is us, it is you who are the kafirs. In other words, in a sense, we need to use these terms not so much to describe others, but to think about ourselves. And when it comes, we were discussing yesterday motivation. It is really dangerous to start assuming how someone else is motivated. It is very you're getting in really tricky ground if we see someone doing something and we therefore start to say, this is therefore their motivation. It is really tricky ground, and it's really tricky when we actually see someone having a spiritual difficulty and we actually start to immediately say, their faith is weak. Or they have no faith. It's not accurate even. It may be the case sometimes. It may be the individual. But it is far better to assume this is a Vaishnav. They have some faith. They've shown some commitment. There is some challenge they're having. It may be internal. It may be external. But we should be very, very... And this goes on in politics a lot. We see some behavior. We immediately start to preach about, in our political way, some defect in the motivation of that person. But one needs to be really careful about that. These instructions about motivation are meant primarily for ourselves. What is my motivation? Ravindra Swarup writes a very interesting article where he talks about the Mayavadis. And he said he had this idea when he started reading about the Mayavadis that Srila Prabhupada kind of got, he said, who are these people? Is it a kind of group in India with whom Prabhupada has a personal vendetta? He was thinking in this way. And after a while it dawned on him, ah, it's for us. It's we who are the Mayavadis. And in a sense, that's not to say devotees are Mayavadis, but us means that we need to look, how much have I got these tendencies for karma and for jnana and for yoga and so on? It is meant for us. That's an important point. And I'm going to read this on, a little further on this, because Srila Prabhupada goes on in this in this section, if I can find it again, in terms of beneficiary. Very interesting. So Srila Prabhupada seems to be being quite strict. You can't apply bhakti to anyone but Krishna. That Prabhupada, that is bhakti yoga, because they accept God. Unless you accept God, there is no question of bhakti yoga. By God, we'll have to assume, I think quite rightly, that he means a personal concept of God. Unless you accept God, there is no question of bhakti yoga. So the Christian religion is also Vaishnavism because they accept God. Maybe in the some stage different from this. There are different stages of God realization. Also, the Christian religion says God is great, as does Islam, except this is very good. But just how great God is, that you can understand from Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam. But there is acceptance that God is great. That is therefore the beginning of bhakti, and you can apply that bhakti. Even the Muslim religion, that is also bhakti yoga. Any religion where God is the target, that is applied in bhakti. Interesting. Bhakti yoga means bhaja jayukti bhaja sevaya, service. Service means three things. The servitor, the served, and the service. One must be present who will accept service. In other words, Srila Prabhupada is saying, if someone is serving, there must be some object of that service. And one must be present to render service. And the via media, that which connects the servitor and that who he who is served, is the service itself. If there is nobody to accept the service, then where is the bhakti yoga? So any philosophy or religious principle where there is no acceptance of God the Supreme, there is no application of bhakti. Yes. Interesting, isn't it? And so Srila Prabhupada made this point very clearly for the personal conception of God. And there was one tape I listened to some times ago where Srila Prabhupada got into quite a strong argument with one impersonalist, and he was quoting simply one line from the Gita. Nitya yukta upasate. Upasate means serve, worship. Nitya yukta. Yukta means engaged, and nitya means eternally. So Srila Prabhupada was just saying, nitya yukta upasate. That means eternally engaged in service. That means there is eternally a servitor and he who is served, an object of service. Therefore, the Mayavadi concept that actually the self merges with the Supreme, the servitor becomes the served, is wrong. Otherwise, there's no nitya yukta upasate. So, I mean, just take one line of the Gita, and you can use that to actually contend with the pure Advaitic concept. However, as mentioned in this verse, there are different concepts of God. We actually do believe there are many different deities, as prevalent in Karma Yoga. We also understand as Vaishnavs that there is the impersonal Brahman. We are the same as God, qualitatively. That's important to recognize. We do take shelter of the Lord within the heart. We have to, even to get a spiritual master. We have to take shelter of the Supreme. We're always taking shelter for knowledge, remembrance, and so on. And we need to become aware of the Supreme Lord to guide us in our spiritual life. Not always, Guru Maharaj, I've got a problem. Guru Maharaj, I've got another problem. Guru Maharaj is not really meant for solving all our problems. We have to also start to develop some spiritual insight, some self-reliance. The super soul is there, and ultimately, it's interesting here how the super soul is engraved in the heart. Did you notice that part in the translation of this verse, the words? Becomes engraved in the heart. Engraved. It's etched in the heart. Not just painted on the heart, it's actually etched in there, deep in the heart. So the super soul is there, and then there's the Supreme Personality of Godhead also. It needs some maturity to understand and some discrimination the relationship between the different processes and to actually avoid becoming over dismissive of the other types of yoga, and on the other hand becoming too engrossed perhaps in the other forms of yoga. And Srila Prabhupada, just to finish, I'll read from the 6th chapter of the Gita, the final verse, Yoginam api sarvesham. The culmination of all kinds of yoga practice lies in bhakti yoga. All other yogas are but means to come to the point of bhakti in bhakti yoga. Yoga actually means bhakti yoga. In all other yogas are progressions towards the destination of bhakti yoga. From the beginning of karma yoga to the end of bhakti yoga is a long way to self-realization. Karma yoga without fruitive results is the beginning of this path. By the way, karma yoga is different from being a karmi. Prabhupada makes that clear. When karma yoga increases in knowledge and renunciation, the stage is called jnana yoga. When jnana yoga increases in meditation on the super soul by different physical processes and the mind is on him, it is called astanga yoga. And when one surpasses the astanga yoga to come to the point of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, it is called bhakti yoga, the culmination. Factually, bhakti yoga is the ultimate goal, but to analyze bhakti yoga minutely, I'll read that again, but to analyze bhakti yoga minutely, one has to understand these other yogas. The yogi who is progressive is therefore on the true path of eternal good fortune. One who sticks to a particular point and does not make further progress is called by that particular name, karma yogi, jnana yogi, or dhyana yogi, raja yogi, hatha yogi, etc. If one is fortunate enough to come to the point of bhakti yoga, it is to be understood that he has surpassed all other yogas. Therefore, to become Krishna conscious is the highest stage of yoga. Just as when we speak of the Himalayas, we refer to the world's highest mountains, of which the highest peak, Mount Everest, is considered to be the culmination. It is by great fortune that one comes to Krishna consciousness or the path of bhakti yoga to be well situated according to the Vedic direction. The ideal yogi concentrates his attention on Krishna, who is called Shama Sundara, who is beautifully colored as a cloud, whose lotus face is as effulgent as the sun, whose dress is brilliant with jewels, and whose body is flower garlanded, illuminating all sides is his gorgeous luster, which is called the Brahma Jyoti. He is the perfect. I'll read on a little bit. He is known as Krishna, Govinda, and Vasudev. He is the perfect child, husband, friend, and master, and he is full with all opulence and transcendental qualities. If one remains fully conscious of these features of the Lord, he is called the highest yogi. The highest stage of perfection of yoga can be attained only by bhakti yoga, as confirmed in all Vedic literature. Yasya deve para bhaktiya yata deve tata guru tasyaite katita hyatak prakashanti mahatmanaha. only unto those souls who have implicit faith in both the Lord and the Supreme Master are all the imports of Vedic knowledge automatically revealed. Bhakti yoga means devotional service to the Lord, which is free from desire for material profit, either in this life or in the next. Devoid of all such inclinations, one should absorb the mind in the Supreme. That is the purpose of Naishkarmya. Interesting summary of the sixth chapter of the Gita. Questions? Yes, Manoha Prabhu. Well, I mean, there seems to be, Srila Prabhupada suggests if one is progressive, that one will actually attain the ultimate goal. However, to attain bhakti, you must have the seed of bhakti as given by the Supreme Lord who directs one to the spiritual master, a pure devotee. That must be there. However, one can assume that if the yogi is sincere and progressive, he will actually come to that point of self-realization. Whereas if the yogi is not sincere to make progress and becomes attached to the results of the other types of yoga, he or she will not come to that platform. And without coming to that platform, one may again slip from the path. Although it's interesting that Srila Prabhupada says in the sixth chapter that one who is sincere in yoga will not meet with any destruction. One will come again to the path. But it does, it's interesting, that touch of bhakti must always be there for success. Without that bhakti, one can't be successful. Did I answer your question? No. Absolutely. I think we should be careful of the word automatic. The word automatically tends to apply to machines. Yantra Rudani Maya, the body is a machine. We're endeavoring for spiritual realization. But it is clear that you don't need any other, bhakti doesn't need any other cause. However, one should also be careful to develop the qualities of a devotee and to be introspective, to see if we are progressing in spiritual life. Bhaktivinoda Thakur suggests that every Ekadashi, we actually reflect, we use that day to reflect on our progress in the previous 2 weeks. So it's not, when we say automatically, we're not saying that actually one just kind of goes on blindly applying the practices of devotional service without some form of introspection as to whether my heart is becoming free from jnana, and the desire for yogic results, or indeed the desire for fruitive results through karma. So one needs to be, I think that word automatically needs to be looked at. Certainly bhakti doesn't need the other processes, but of course bhakti involves knowledge of the Supreme Lord we're discussing. It involves activities connected to the Supreme Lord, and it involves meditation on the form of the Lord. Therefore, that object of knowledge, or the beneficiary being Krishna, is an important principle. That is an important principle. coming to complete purity is also important. But sometimes the elements that we engage in are not so important, as with Maharaj Bharat. He was performing a sacrifice. And certainly, you know, the understanding of the Supreme Lord and the fact that it's directed towards Krishna is important. Does that make sense? Further questions or comments? Or is it clear, or is it more confusing? Huh? I think, yeah, I mean, there are those four elements. Yes, Prabhu, you had a question? Comment? Yeah. Srila Prabhupada never encouraged that. He was much more concerned that actually one is, if you listen to Srila Prabhupada's conversations, so he was much more concerned that people actually follow. So that actually sincerity and that personal integrity he deemed more important than the tradition you follow, provided it was theistic, of course. And therefore he said to the Christians, you know, thou shalt not kill, why are you killing? And of course Saint Francis of Assisi was an example of someone who had affinity for the animals and so on. And without that you can't really advance in spiritual life, because without that there's no Brahman realization. As soon as one realizes Brahman, samak sarveshu bhuteshu, you see every living entity equally. How can you engage in violence towards another living? It's not possible if you have that realization. Srila Prabhupada ki jai, Shri Radha Gopinath ki jai.
Dear devotees, just 1.5 minute. I got a message from a travel agency. What was the name again? Gauranga Travel Agency. There are some last minute tickets for Harinam in Ghent today. So in case you can free yourself, there are some. It's an opportunity. There are such towns where Mother Gopal, Shamananda Prabhu. So if you want to fight with us together, become a transcendental warrior, Rupa Sanatan, so many transcendental things, Mangalavati Mataji. So please come, if you can, a last minute decision. There are some extra places on the bus. 10:15 on the guest house, the big parking lot. There is prasadam on the bus also. Srila Prabhupada ki. Gopim.